Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, it seems like summer has arrived early. We've already got a lot of summer-like temperatures. We're here looking at the possibility of, if things continue like this, a good 4.5 months' worth of 80-degree highs. And chances are you may be thinking, maybe you haven't turned on your air conditioning yet, but you may be thinking about things that you can do around the home to try to keep cool and comfortable and try to keep your bills as low as possible. And we'll see if we can make some suggestions along those lines here this morning as we talk once again with our energy guru. Oh, we just made him cringe, ladies and gentlemen. Larry Lister is his name. He's a mechanical engineer with Facility Dynamics Engineering. It's a consulting engineering firm that specializes in building automation and operation and maintenance of commercial buildings. So in his professional work, he's particularly interested in works with big buildings. But here when he's on the show, we scale things back a little bit, and we try and talk about things on the single-family home level. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You have questions. I promise I'll never say that again. You know, when I was getting ready to do the show here, I went to my files and I pulled out a list of suggested topics. When we did, I think this is from the very first show that we did.
When I was young and naive.
When you were young and naive. And I'm not sure how long ago this was. But the thing that struck me was that on this page of possible questions, the number two thing on your list was, what happened to the energy crisis?
Well, it's back.
It's back.
Hello.
That was my thought exactly. And I started me thinking, now, how is it that in such a relatively short period of time we could have had what we called a crisis? We could be talking a lot about efficiency and conservation. Then we went into this period where it seemed like we just didn't care, and people would buy, you know.
It's called the 80s, David.
These tanks, you know, that they're driving around that get 7 miles to the gallon.
Okay.
And now suddenly we wake up one day and we've got a crisis again, and people are talking about power shortages and rolling blackouts. And once again here, we're starting, I think just starting to get back to that place that we were before when we're starting to think about, gosh, what can we do so that we can use less energy?
Right. Yeah, and I'm waiting for all the snake oil salesmen to come out of the woodwork with their perpetual motion machines and all kinds of energy saving things that cost five times more than they should and probably don't do half of what they should. But I'm sure that'll be fodder for a lot of future shows. Yeah, as far as this energy crisis thing, you know, the one thing that in the last couple of years since I've been working more out in the real world, as they call it here on campus, I've actually gotten less political about a lot of this, and so I'm following it less, more as a sanity measure so that I can sleep at night. On the other hand, you know, last week and two weeks prior to that, I've been working in California. I'm doing a lot of work in California right now, and it's really interesting having a front row seat for this energy debacle. And I think California is just the start of it. Deregulation. I think the answer to your question, though, and this is as much gut feel as any kind of deep knowledge that I might have, is that it's really political. I mean, think about it. We had an energy crisis in the 70s, and in the late 70s, there was no energy, and all kinds of things were going to happen. Well, we've been burning energy and burning fossil fuel and taking stuff out of the ground and doing all that, like, they're, you know, for 20 years. We have 20 years less of that stuff than we had in the 70s. Now, all of a sudden, you know, we're saying, oh, we know that. Really, it's more of an economic thing. It's a supply and demand thing. There's pipelines. There's all kinds of things. And there's political issues at the source of a lot of those pipelines. And things get squeezed closed politically as well as some cases socioeconomically. And those ripple all the way up and down the chain.
Yeah.
Boy, there's no easy answer to it. And then in the case of California, this deregulation where they said, well, you know, we're going to let anybody supply power to anybody. And they didn't, I don't think they thought it through. I think that's as much of a political business issue as it is an energy problem. It's exacerbated right now by the fact that it didn't rain or didn't snow as much in Western Canada and in the Pacific Northwest this year. So all of a sudden, you know, California, who are sort of like little birdies in the nest with gaping mouths open looking for power from the hydro dams up in Seattle. Well, there's no water. And if there's no water, you can't drop it. And if you can't drop it, you can't turn a turbine. You can't turn a turbine, you can't send electricity. So all of a sudden, everybody's struggling.
Well, right now, too, I guess what strikes me is that right after on your list of questions here, what happened to the energy crisis was, why isn't energy efficiency more mainstream? And it seems that even now we got this big problem, and what are we talking about? How can we burn more Illinois coal? People are actually starting to talk about building new nuclear power plants. We're talking about building new, other kinds of generation. No, it doesn't really seem to be anybody, at least not very loudly, is talking about efficiency and conservation. In fact, the vice president the other day came right out and said, we can't conserve ourselves out of this problem. Why here now? Even now, okay, we were saying, okay, we got a crisis again, but we still don't seem to be saying anything very much about, well, okay, what can we do to actually use less?
Yeah, well, I'm going to promise myself I'm not going to get started on the vice president's remarks, but the fact of the matter is we elected two people from the big oil business to government, so. What's our energy policy going to look like? Now, in their defense, at least they're aware of energy. I had great hopes over the last 8 years that there was going to be some energy work done, and it really never did happen. We could have set the stage differently. So there's plenty of blame to be shared here. And also, I don't know that I would say that in a sense, he was correct that we're not going to conserve our way out of this. And there's probably a supply requirement in the mix. But I think that I walk into huge buildings in major metropolitan areas or wherever they happen to be. I walk into huge buildings that are drawing enormous amounts of power. And I walk around those buildings and I work with them and I make stuff come on and off. And that's what we do. And there is so much energy wasted. And it's just amazing. And to me, if I was going to go mining something, the first thing I'd be mining is conservation. But the problem is that it's not a simple fix. It's not as a lot of people would want us to believe, well, you go out and you buy a more efficient chiller or buy a more efficient air conditioner for your home. Mm-hmm. Buy a more efficient this, buy a more efficient that. Because really, down in the trenches where the buildings actually operate and where they work is inside the processors of the control systems. It's down at the little valve and damper level of all the equipment strewn around all these buildings up in the ceilings and stuff. And it's really like trench warfare. Making a building really work well, it's not a simple fix. You can't just take a spreadsheet and do some nice, clean calculation and drive up with a new black box chiller or whatever it happens to be on a skid, drop it off, connect it up, and you're efficient. Because it's really the limbs of the buildings that are paralyzed, mm-hmm. and the brains aren't helping. To fix that, it requires some money, and it requires a fair bit of a lot of my job is technical. A lot of it gets into business type issues of why is the business of this facility doing things this way. A lot of it gets down to operation and maintenance. Those people don't have enough money to keep buildings going. Unfortunately, when you say we could conserve, I think we could conserve our way out of it. But it would have to be such a mindset at so many levels, the residential, the people in their houses. I live right down the street on Main Street. I've got students living on either side of my house. And I've had air conditioners running for a month. It was beautiful weather.
Yeah, open the window.
Air conditioners running. Now, I don't know. Maybe they're allergic or they have some kind of problems. But nonetheless, it's so the problem is so multidisciplinary. And when you really get down to it, there's psychology, there's all kinds of things come into play. I wish it was just as simple as buy a new air conditioner and everything will be fine. But you should buy a new air conditioner if you need one.
Well, we got some people we're going to talk to. We'll see if we can maybe deal with this on a slightly more practical sort of immediate level. And also,
unless the vice president calls.
Unless the vice president
calls. All bets are off.
Mr. Cheney calls. and also on future shows, we're starting to talk here among ourselves on Focus 580 about how we can try to talk about some of these things. So I'll promise we're going to get back to some of these issues.
Yeah,
but right for the moment here, well, let's see what's on the mind of folks who are listening. We'll start in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, I've got sort of a small-scale residential question.
Sure.
The house we're in, we've been in this house for 4 years, and it has an attic fan, which is a great idea, except it's this little bitty attic fan for a big attic. And we know we've got to do something different. And my husband was thinking of getting a turbine because it doesn't take electricity, et cetera, et cetera. And we talked to the contractor that often does things for us, and he said, never get a turbine because then they start to shake and they whine and this and that. And once it's in, you can't do anything about it. So we're wondering, should we get a very big fan or should we put in a turbine?
You're talking about
to cool the attic.
Ventilate the attic and cool the attic.
Yeah, it gets real hot up there, and then, of course, you know, it gets hot down here.
Yeah, I'm saying that as opposed to a whole house fan that's there to actually pull air through your house into your attic.
And out.
Yeah. Well, one way to ventilate an attic and give yourself some comfort is to do, in fact, that, is to do a powered whole house type fan. And I, as anybody that listens to this show very often knows, I'm a huge proponent of those. I don't have a house that can take one right now, and I really miss it because I've been lucky enough to have them in the past. And that does actually help to ventilate the attic because you pressurize the attic with air from the house. You've drawn air from outside through your house, cooled everybody off, and then you're sending it into the attic and blowing it out. Now, the problem is on a really hot day when that's turned off, your attic can build up heat. The issue, there's a lot of issues surrounding whether you need to ventilate roofs. Now, you're talking about ventilating an attic to keep heat from building up, and you could also insulate your way out of that problem.
Well, we have insulation.
Okay. Is it on the roof? Is it at the roof plane, or is it at the ceiling plane of the attic? You know, is it on the floor of the attic or the?
I'm not sure. You know, the attic is only partially floored, and I haven't really been up there. But, you know, my recollection is that the fan is over the garage part of the roof, of the attic. And it's cooling that part of the attic, but, boy, it's nowhere near big enough to, you know, ventilate the entire attic.
Yeah. The way I would approach this, and it really gets down to the specifics of your house, and the contractor could probably talk you through this. The best way to do it, if you want to insulate that attic, is to, first of all, make sure that the floor is insulated so your house is thermally broken from the attic. So no matter what it does in the attic, whether it's cold in the winter or hot in the summer, right, you're not going to pay to help the attic be whatever you don't want it to be. But once you do that, if you could talk to your contractor about, for one thing, I don't like active means like powered fans and things like that if you don't really need them. Just because it can just be a headache. There's a lot of passive ways to do it. The turbine is one, and those, if they're not level and some things happen, and as they get older, they can get squeaky. So your contractor has some valid issues. However, it's not that the minute you put it in, it's gonna be a pain. The other way to do it is just to cut a ridge vent, depending on if you have ridge, to cut vents high, cut vents low, and just let nature do its thing. Because the hot air rises, it's gonna flow out. And cool air is going to come in underneath to take its place. We actually have, I don't know what the deal is over at the U of I, what used to be the Small Homes Counselor, Bill Rose and those guys.
They don't take calls anymore.
They don't take calls.
No, you have to call the extension service, and they'll find somebody who will answer your question.
Okay. I wonder if Bill Rose still gets a lot of those calls. Bill is a wealth of information on this stuff. They've done tons of research over there, and I occasionally have to email him or talk to him or read his stuff to find out what they're recommending, because they really look at a lot of these issues and a lot more.
What was his name?
Bill Rose. Bill, he actually does. He does.
Yeah, he's here occasionally on the show. He's, because he's an architect, and we've done a number of shows with him about architecture and design sorts of issues. But also we've dealt with other sorts of things like, you know, the problem of moisture.
Yep.
And how you deal with that, which is something he's really
he does a lot
into.
Of work in those areas.
So
too. You know, and that's at the research level, yeah. But it directly translates into really useful results.
Yeah. And you were saying ridge vents.
Yeah, your contractor will definitely know about these because this is really what they do in most houses. Is you put a vent up high, just a you just make an opening in the roof that's covered with a little roof of its own.
Uh-huh.
They call them ridge vents if they're on the ridge, which is the straight part of the top of the roof. If you have a hip roof, which has angles and stuff, then there's some other ways to do it. But talk to your contractor and just talk to them about putting some ventilation down near the soffit, down low, toward the bottom of the roof, and then something up high for it to go, and just letting it flow in the bottom and flow out the top.
Okay.
And he should be able to come up with some decent strategies.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to line number two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hello there. I've got a question about heating, actually, to prepare for next winter. Do you know anything about heated floors, hot water running through the floor?
Yeah.
I have a slab foundation, so I can't, you know, so right now the heat comes through the ceiling of forced air and old furnace, mm-hmm. and it's just really inefficient. So I was thinking the heated floor thing might be an option.
Floor heating, you talk about hydronic floor heating where you take, you know, a boiler, which heats water instead of air,
right.
and pumps it around, and then they usually do it on a place where you don't have a floor yet, and you embed the tubing, it's like a poly tubing, mm-hmm. they embed it into the floor and serpentine it around so it's nice, even temperature. And it's just a wonderful way to heat. It's so comfortable and it's quite efficient. And I can't say enough good things about it. I've been in places that had floor heating, and it's mm-hmm. as great as all you see in Europe and Northern Europe and Scandinavia.
So it's efficient. And the question, I mean, couldn't I just lay it down over my, you know, it would require a thin layer of concrete to add on top of my current concrete floor.
Yeah, or you might. It really depends. The problem is that you're talking about raising your floor, and it could be a little bit substantial, because the one thing you don't want to do is put the tubing over the top of the concrete that's there and then put some floor or something in there, because you want to insulate that concrete down below.
So the heat doesn't...
It's going to be a big sink, and you really don't want that at this point. If it were designed new, you would have insulated below that concrete and then put it in the concrete and had your floor. So the only thing here is technically, I'd say, if you can pull it off, you'd be really happy with it.
But I might be looking at something like as much as 6 inches or something.
I don't know about six, but it'd be pretty tough to do it anywhere inside of about three. I'm trying to add fast here. What's one and one and one?
these engineers.
Is there an engineer around here? Yeah. You're talking like 3 inches or so. You don't need a ton of insulation, but the more the better, because you got that concrete. And again, maybe if the concrete's insulated down below, then that part can be unnecessary, and you'd wind up just heating that concrete, but you'd have a nice little chunk of mass to ride out, you know, to even things out. So that concrete could be a help or could be a hindrance. It just depends on what's underneath it, you know, what they've done underneath it.
Okay. Do you have any idea what the cost of a system like that is?
Ooh.
I can check on it.
It can get expensive. Now, the nice thing is you've got duct work, so you can still do cooling.
Right.
So you're really talking about. And the other question is, is it a single story house?
Yes.
And the whole thing's, what kind of floor do you have over the slab?
It's just tile. I mean, old. It was a garage once, so it's the most basic kind of thing you could imagine.
Okay. Yeah. It's small then?
Yes.
Okay. You might do okay here. The question, the thing is it not, that you have to be a little bit careful about in this case, the contractor choice might be a little touchy. You want to make sure you get somebody that really understands and appreciates hydronic heating. There's some local people around who are good contractors, but that just aren't wet heads, as they call them in the business. They just don't like dealing with that liquid. So you want to find a contractor that embraces that whole idea. And there's a couple really good ones here in town.
Okay. And you wouldn't recommend I do it myself?
Ooh. Oh. Got a live one here. I'd be probably stupid enough to try it myself.
Yeah.
But that's me.
Yeah.
My wife would counsel you otherwise.
Right. Well, so would any sane person, but.
Yeah. But no, I wouldn't do this one myself. Number one, just the devil's in the details. This thing can really go south on you fast if you do it wrong. If you do it right, it's fabulous and low maintenance and everything's good. But there's so many little, you don't want to learn.
Okay.
Not when you're, yeah.
Okay.
I appreciate what you're saying. I really do. But
yeah. All
right. Let's hold off on that.
Thanks for the information.
Okay. Sure. You can do a lot of work to help prep the job for a contractor. If you really have a good hand at doing stuff yourself, a lot of times you can really knock the cost of a job down if you just get with the contractor early and say, hey, listen, you know, I want you to do the stuff you do well, but prep and clean up and you know, if you need, what do you need to come in and knock this thing out fast and let me do as much of that as I can. Because a lot of times, up to half the job sometimes can be stuff that anybody could do themselves, and you wind up paying for it.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. We're about midpoint here already with our guest, Larry Lister. He's a mechanical engineer. He has a business. He's called Facility Dynamics Engineering, and that's a consulting engineering firm, and they're particularly interested in energy efficiency, operation, and maintenance of commercial buildings. But he's here occasionally on the show, and we talk about things you can do in the single-family home, basically with the same goal, that is to make it as energy efficient as possible. And last time he was here, I think it was still cold. Was it cold when
you were last? Yeah, it was like last week.
No, okay.
A month ago.
Anyway, last time he was here, it was cold.
Where's spring?
Now it's hot, so the bottom line is still the same. We want to keep the bill down, but the concerns have changed a little bit. So if you have questions, you can call us. Here we go. Let's go to I don't. You
actually, that well that other the other caller brought up a really good issue in that this is the time when we're all worried about cooling, and that's the kind of the way it tends to work. But this is the time to buy heating right now. This is when you want to buy heating, and in the fall or the winter is when you want to
buy your AC. Okay. Well, let's talk with another caller here in Peoria, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. What happened to solar, wind, and water?
They're still out there.
I don't think that they're using it.
No, they're not using it that much. No. The good news that I have on that I think on that right now. I was actually doing solar energy work in the 80s when it was me and like three other people in the United States. But it is still out there, and there's been a lot of quiet, nice technical advances in solar. Wind has just gone gangbusters. Wind is quite the conventional energy technology in a lot of parts of the country, and I think we're going to see more of it here. If you've been to Iowa, it's amazing. There's wind farms popping up everywhere. The drive from Des Moines up to Minneapolis, there's about a 50-mile stretch where you can almost always see a huge wind turbine or a wind farm on the horizon. With wind, what's happened is there's been some great technology advances. There's been better detection of where the wind resources are, and there are a lot of them in the United States, and they're not all in Tehachapi Pass, California. They're, in fact, right here on the plains, up near the Great Lakes, just nice, steady, big winds.
You know, about 50 years ago, they used heat to produce coal. They had refrigerators that would have this system.
Yeah, they still do. U of I does a lot of their cooling from steam here. The U of I is one of the largest users of absorption chilling technology. It's a great place. If you're working and you're interested in that area, coming to U of I is a great thing. And they do a good job keeping it up, too. I got to hand it to them.
Thank you.
Okay.
There's a lot of good. Yeah, the solar thing, I'm getting a lot of questions on solar right now. And solar is a great, appropriate way to do some fairly well-defined small things, at least at the home level. Wind is almost not even appropriate at the farm or home level anymore, you know, single wind turbine. But where wind has become appropriate is in these massive, building a power plant out on a bean field somewhere.
Yeah.
And so in a way, it's nice that these alternative technologies, while they're definitely adaptable at the residential level, they're really being done pretty well at the central level. as a way to mitigate building new coal plants and some of these things. And wind is just catching fire.
One of the big complaints in the past, I think people had made about wind turbines is they made a lot of noise, so that you didn't want to live near a wind farm. Is that still as much of a problem?
The noise that, as I understand it, the noise that, and I've been near a couple large wind farms recently. They've done a lot to lose the noise because it got into frequencies and fundamentals and harmonics and things that they were able to just, that stinks. It's designed around that. So they just changed some of the things. They've got some variable speed rotor type things that they do when they start to hit a harmonic. They just change a little bit. And a lot of the noise that is a problem, or that I understand to be a problem, is at the lower frequencies, the subaudible level. And I've heard of some complaints about structural problems. You kind of like train, when you're near a train track, you get this low frequency stuff that you don't hear, but your house hears it and sometimes doesn't like it. But in general, I think they've really come around and changed a lot of that. And they're putting these things remote. They're out in the middle of nowhere.
It's where there's nobody around to.
Yeah, and complain. They can still farm around them too, which is kind of great. They can actually get dual use out of fields and things.
We got some other folks here. Let's. We got a car phone here, and we want to get to. I'm on number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had questions about geothermal heating and cooling. I know that it sounds like it's a good idea, but I also understand that you're still using a fair amount of electricity, and the time during which the power company sort of cuts you some slack is during the winter, and that depends upon how much energy you use during the summer, et cetera. And so I'm just wondering about your views on geothermal heating and cooling as far as efficiency and dependability, because I guess if you have a malfunction, it could be quite expensive to fix, and it may take a long time to recover your initial investment costs.
Okay.
With that, if it's okay, I'll hang up and listen to you.
Sure thing. Great. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Boy, we're getting these almost every time now, and that indicates to me that somebody's doing their marketing out there. My kind of quick take on geothermal, which is really what we're talking about, is heat pumps. And when they say geothermal, specifically, that implies ground or water source heat pumps, where you're rejecting the heat, or in this case of a heat pump, you're rejecting it sometimes, and other times you hit the reversing valve, and then you're gathering heat or energy, thermal energy, depending on which direction you run. It's like an air conditioner that you can run backwards and heat. The geothermal part is that in the early days of heat pumps, and these still exist in a lot of places, and they're technically fine, there was air source heat pumps. And you were stuck rejecting, you were stuck trying to get cool from the warm, I'm going to really botch this from an engineering point of view, but if all the engineering professors turn their radios down for a second. You're trying to get cool from hot air, and you're trying to get hot from cool air, which tends to not work so well. In the winter, when you want heat, your source is cold outside air. With geothermal, you're either burying a bunch of tubing in the ground, which is stable temperature, more stable for sure, or if you have a lake or a pond or something. So you're really kind of going to this constant source, and a semi-infinite source as far as the heat pump's concerned. So the geothermal tend to be more efficient and work better than the air source. And that was what the caller was referring to as geothermal. Okay, once you've gotten that far, the question comes down to, technically, is this the snake oil I was talking about earlier in the hour, or is it good, firm, good technology? It is good technology. It's great technology. These things they work well. They're in place in a lot of parts of the country. It's the common way to do it, or it's a common way to do it. They're making inroads north. Where it tends to work better is in the south. They're great. They're great ways to cool, and they're getting to be better and better ways to heat. But the caller was correct on a lot of counts. The other one is that you're using electricity to do it. Depends on the power company and what they'll do for you. But as it gets colder and colder and colder, it gets less and less efficient to use a heat pump for heating. So that's a little bit of the downside, although they are still, I would consider them a pretty efficient way to do it. The other issue the caller raised was the cost.
Yeah, And they ain't cheap.
Nope. They get you. So it comes down to now with the price of natural gas doubling, and who knows what's going to happen to electricity. I mean, things are it's going to be rock and roll for a while here. And as 2 months ago and 2 years ago, I was saying, great technology. If somebody would give me one, I would love to have it. But I don't see the money. I don't see the dollars there for where we are. If you're in the southern part of the listening areas, you know, southern Indiana, places like that, it gets to already be more cost effective. We're right on the cusp. With energy prices changing the way they are, who knows? That could change.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I haven't done those analyses because it's just not the area that I work in. But I know there are places that are re-looking at all this and saying, at what point does electricity have to get, or does natural gas, which is usually what you're trading off, does natural gas have to get so expensive? And then what does the corresponding electricity rate do to make these things more cost-effective? And if they get more cost-effective, two things can happen. The people that are selling them can either raise the price even more, or the market can respond, and all of a sudden, instead of one or two people in any location, you've got eight people that can sell them, and then the price comes down.
Yeah, you still could be looking at a pretty long payback period, though.
Yeah, they have a pretty decent lifespan, but the payback can be long. It really depends on if you're. I've talked to folks that have them that paid some fairly ridiculous premiums for them. And if you look, you say, if you go down to Kentucky or somewhere, Tennessee, and look at what it costs to put these things in and look at what it costs here in central Illinois, should it be 30% higher for the same thing? Is our ground is that much different?
Is it that harder to dig the trench?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, we have somebody else here. Other questions are welcome, by the way. We're talking this morning with Larry Lister. He's a mechanical engineer. His thing is energy efficiency and design, construction, operation of buildings. And every once in a while he stops by here and we talk a little bit about energy in the home, single-family home, things you can do to make it more efficient. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Atlanta, next caller here, not Georgia. On line four. Hello.
Hello there. How are you guys doing this morning?
Hi, doing good.
I go along with David that the real solution from the homeowner or anybody else is conservation. And from the solar point of view, I live in a passive solar house. I think I've called before and maybe addressed that. And in 20 years of experience, being that it's super insulated also, it's just been tremendous cost savings as far as energy. But as far as the solar aspect of it, in the winter, Illinois is 75% cloudy, which is really detrimental when you really need it. Of course, I'm not addressing the production of electricity. At least you would have 45% of the time where it'd be sunny enough probably to address, have solar-powered cells to make some electricity, which is certainly an option. But again, Illinois is not noted for being sunny very much. The passive water part works good in the summer, but again, in hot water, again in the winter, you really don't get much. I was thinking you were talking about the wind generation. I thought if I was real rich, which I'm really, really not, that I would go to some kind of domestic wind generation for electricity, because being out here in the country, it looks like it's much more windy than it is cloudy. But the one thing that I found as a negative, which not only would apply to the homeowner, which would apply to the large banks, is that the wind generators kill large amounts of migrating birds. So my question is, have you heard anything negative in that respect? And again, what would be the reasons that a homeowner couldn't make that work for him?
Well, great question and great lead up too. I mean, look at when people do. No, I want to address your passive thing. For everybody else, I lived in a passive solar home for a number of years here in Illinois, and I can tell this caller has the same gut feel. You just know the weather. I used to be able to lay in bed at night and know when it got cloudy. It puts you in touch when you're living in a house that is using the environment for some of its heat source or is well insulated and trying to keep the environment out. You just become so much more in tune to what's going on, and it's really fun. And you're really making me miss that, by the way.
That is really true. Every morning when you wake up, you look to see what the day is going to bring.
Yeah, you're just a little more sensitive to what's happening around you. You're sensitive to humidity and stuff. It was fun. And anybody that's building, you have so many opportunities to do things either correctly or incorrectly. And once they're done, and you're stuck. And, you know, this caller talks about having a very well-insulated home. Paying attention to all those details is just, I can't stress how critical it is for, and that house is going to be there hopefully for 100 or more years. Boy, don't set somebody up with something that, you know, that they're going to regret in the future. Let's go to the wind thing. Yeah, the bird issue in these wind farms has been a big deal, and it surprised the wind industry early on. Again, I'm not a wind expert. I kind of keep my ear to the ground on wind stuff just because I started off as an aeronautical engineer and I got interested in wind, and then I got interested in energy, and then pretty soon I wasn't interested in aeronautical engineering anymore. But the situation with the bird migration is they're doing all kinds of things at the turbine level to scare birds away, and I don't know exactly what those are, so I'm gonna be honest and plead a little bit of ignorance. But I do know that there's a lot of noise type ways that they're trying to mitigate this to make these wind farms, because you've got a whole meat cleaver full of wind turbines, and they're big. These things are huge, and they put them out there, so yeah, they can want birds that are trying to fly through them. So what I've understood that they do is that they've used some sound type, and this doesn't mean audible sound to human ears, but they've used some ways to make those areas just less friendly to a bird flying through, so that a bird would sort of naturally avoid it. I'm trying to recall. I actually read an article probably 4 or 5 years ago about some other things they were doing to avoid the dead bird problem. But there are going to be dead birds in wind farms. That's just the way it happens. At the residential level, the wind turbines that are made for the residential scale are smaller, and because, you know, there's one little point in a big amount of space, statistically just the chances of a bird getting knocked is quite a bit lower than it is with these wind farms, because you've got square miles full of these things spinning around.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and so I haven't heard at the residential level, I haven't heard of the bird thing. It's really considered more of a wind farm problem. If you just couldn't stand the sight of a dead crow or something, I'm going to sound like, who is that guy from back in the 80s, the Secretary of the Interior?
James Watt.
James Watt.
Yeah.
It's not like James Watt here. But, yeah, I mean, what's a couple dead crows? No.
We have that. The trouble is we have a little bit of trouble with that with the glazing on the south of birds striking that, which is really a heartbreaker.
Right. If you have a passive solar house with a lot of glazing, a lot of large glazing at whatever orientation, usually the south, That's your bird killer. And I do remember that too. You know,
so we got flags flying and claws flying and everything else, and it certainly helps. But we still manage to do our share of damage that way. And it's encouraging to hear that maybe the wind generator, because not having the attraction in such a small area, might not be as bad as I thought.
Yeah, but as far as at the residential scale, you know, I don't really know what the economics of that looks like now. It's fairly outrageous, and Illinois is not shouldn't say this because I'm not sure if there's anything pending or changed recently, but Illinois was not, over the last 10 years, has not really been terribly friendly to letting you feed power back into the grid.
Well, now, that part's true, but with the climate change, I think we are getting windier. I haven't seen the statistics, but looking outside,
it sure seems
like we're getting windier anyway. So,
of course, we're not dealing with climate change here in the United States.
No, absolutely not. I you know, looking out every day, I realize that.
See, David, see what happened? You start off political,
look
what you did to me.
It's my fault. I'll accept responsibility.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thanks
for the call. Got about 10 minutes left.
We could have been talking air conditioners, but no.
About 10 minutes left here with engineer Larry Lister, talking about energy efficiency around the home. You got questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we have a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
You mentioned earlier in the program that you didn't have a house that would take a whole house fan. How do you tell whether your house will take a whole house fan?
Well, I think if you really wanted to do it, any house could. We could figure a way to do it in about any house. You just need about a 3-foot radius somewhere to put the fan. I mean, you can mount them in the walls, but you get architectural issues and all kinds of other things. The way that you...
Is there clearance between the ceiling and the roof in the attic or what?
Well, I'll talk about my house for a second. I've got a 2-story house with a finished attic, so it's really kind of a 3-story house.
Oh.
So all of a sudden, my floor that I would put a whole house fan in is now a floor. Little kids running around on it and stuff. So that's the main deal killer. Is if you don't have the attic anymore. But if you have some ceiling space, usually you do it above a stairwell is the common place to put a whole house fan. As you're walking upstairs, to say to a second floor, or you can do it on a single-story house too, but you would, put it in the stair. As you're walking up the stairs, it would be in that area, a big empty area up there. It's not used for anything else, really.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. And is this a particularly expensive sort of thing to do?
No, that's the nice thing. They're really quite cheap, these whole house fans. And the technology we're talking about, because we didn't really cover the basic layout, is that it's a big fan designed to move a lot of air at low pressure drop. And it's when you turn it on, usually you would open the windows in your house, you would turn the whole house fan on, it makes the house negatively pressured, pulls air in from all the open windows, and you can tune however you want the airflow in your house and open the ones you want and close the ones you want. Brings in air from all those different places, brings it right through the house and sucks it out the ceiling into the attic, and then you have to have a way for it to get out of the attic. Don't blow the roof off your house. If you put a whole house fan in, you got to have a hole somewhere else for the air to go. And it when you're running it, it's great. It does it does a good job of ventilating the attic, but it's just a comfortable way to go, unless the humidity is really high, and then you tend to shut them down, which it seems like it's getting worse too, doesn't it? But in the shoulder seasons, these spring and fall and cool summer nights when the humidity's gone, it's just a great way to keep cool. And you're moving air across your body, which is one of the tenets we always talk about, of how do you stay comfortable, move some air around. You can actually cheat 2 or 3 degrees higher on air temperature if you can just move it a little bit, and you'll feel as comfortable. So it's really great. I really love it. I grew up with one. My mom doesn't use it anymore because she's kind of buried in the air conditioning up there. But Mom, give it a try. She's probably listening.
Let's go to line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. We have a house that was built around 1950, and instead of normal windows, it has fixed panes of glass, which started out very thick, like 1/4 inch, and we've replaced most of them with double panes. So that part of it's fine. But for ventilation, it has these things that are like wooden. They're sort of like casement windows. They crank open and shut. They're about as thick as an ordinary wooden door. In fact, I'm wondering if that's what they were made from. I'm not sure. But those are what open and shut and are screened. Do you have any idea how efficient those are energy-wise? I mean, we've talked about replacing those with casement windows, but that's kind of a costly thing, too.
Wow.
It's really wacky. No one's ever seen it before.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, that's a new one on me.
Yeah. I mean, how efficient is an ordinary door as compared to, like, a double-pane window or something?
A solid door?
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Is it?
Not bad. I mean, as far as heat loss, now the thing that concerns me more is how leaky is it, how much. It's not so much that if it were all nice and tight, I'd say from a thermal point of view, you're probably fine.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a pretty wacky thing to live with, but
it is, and they tend to swell, and you have to go out and clean them every now and then, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, my standard window diatribe in 30 seconds is that just replacing semi-decent windows with new windows from an energy basis is there's no grounds for it from a cost basis. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of great reasons to get a new window if the functionality of what you have isn't great, if you can't ventilate, if you can't open it and cool your house off and you wind up air conditioning when you shouldn't. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of other things that come into it, and there's a lot of great reasons to replace windows. It improves the value of the house if you have new windows. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good things, reasons to do it. Very rarely would it pay back on an energy savings basis.
Okay. And so maybe as long as we keep these tightly weather-stripped, if we can, they might be okay?
Yeah. Got to be a conversation piece anyway.
Thanks a lot.
I'm pretty curious.
We'll get one more here. Somebody in a car phone, I think. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Yes. Sorry for the car phone. I don't usually like car phones. But my comment is directed at wind. I think I actually met Larry one time at a father-daughter event, but Champaign-Urbana happens to have one of the world's largest wind turbine manufacturers located in its midst, and
yep.
Illinois, contrary to what has been thought in the past, is going to be seeing significant amounts of wind. In fact, the windiest part that our company has found is in Champaign-Urbana, just outside of on Yankee Ridge, not the housing development, but the little strip of escarpment just west of town, and we're looking forward to installing a wind turbine there. And just briefly, noise is an issue, but remember the maximum amount of noise is when the wind is strongest. And usually we don't site a turbine less than the closest resident would have no more than 50 dBA, which is a sound level equivalent to, say, a quiet conversation in a living room. So they're sited properly, noise is not an issue. And bird kills is an issue, is particular to California, where they sighted them in a very large migration pattern in the Midwest. We do have some geese issues in migration, but there have been turbines installed in Minnesota and Iowa for close to 8 years, and there are no dramatic bird kills. I'm not saying there aren't any, but there are very few and far between, probably similar to what you might have in a house with a significant amount of glazing. I'm sorry to not keep to the topic, but I just couldn't stop myself from adding my comments. So
hey, that's fine. I mean, I think it's very much part of the topic.
Yeah, I do recall meeting the caller, and I kept thinking as the wind thing came up, I kept thinking, ooh, I wonder if I can get some help from those guys on the other side of town on this. But yeah, we do have a company that's a really well thought of manufacturer of wind turbines here, and how Champaign-Urbana got that resource was beyond me, but it was a pretty cool thing to see that come.
I'll just add one more point and get off. The Department of Energy is going to be soon releasing a new wind map of the state of Illinois based off our research, which will show everyone in the state where they're likely to have wind energy. And for those who are familiar with a sustainable community called Stell, that is a very windy area, as well as Monmouth, as well as Champaign, but there are other pockets that will be quite windy, which could be useful for those who are looking for residential wind. And the DOE will also be hosting a Wind Powering America show as a part of the Governor's Energy Conference later this fall in Springfield. And I don't have the date in front of me, but I just wanted to pass that along. But I appreciate the show. I just couldn't stop myself from calling and plugging in wind.
Oh, well, appreciate it. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
We're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time for this time around, but I'm sure that on another day, Larry will come back and we can do it again.
I'll be nicer this time.
Larry Lister, thanks very much.
Woo, thanks.
He's a mechanical engineer with Facility Dynamics Engineering, and occasionally he's here on the program. We talk a little bit about energy efficiency around the home.